got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, what's going on?
Oh, what's going on is my semi-annual regret of being a good instructor.
Well, you got to tell us what's going on there.
Well, I always kind of let the tail wag the dog. I ask the students, you know, when can we expect you? Well, I guess I'm one of the dying breed that doesn't just give multiple choice exams. And I give these kind of complex essay-based exams so I can give lots of partial credit and really, you know, help students learn. And then I give them actual written essays and reports to turn in. But I always kind of, they go, well, can we turn them in after finals? Ah, sure, you know, let's do it. And then here I am after finals giving thoughtful comments when I got to turn in all the grades Monday by noon. So it's now, you know, I do nothing but sit in front of a computer and read student essays, which is wonderful because they're very good. But at the same time, it steals your life. I got to go back to just like the Scantron sheet. I'd be done in 6 minutes. Anyway, all good.
Well, you know, I think it's good that you're such a go-getter, Kevin, because it makes a difference for a lot of people. So even though it's difficult for you, I think we all can say we appreciate it.
That's good. There's no other way to do it right. And I just, I never will surrender to that. It's so important to make sure that they're developing good writing skills and helping them. You know, the best part is they turn in a writing assignment, I edit it. And I show them what they do right and what they do wrong. And then I give it back to them. And I say, here, punch this up a little bit. See if you can fix all this and I'll give you a better grade. And it encourages them to learn how to be better writers. And all of this is so important. And the students tell me they've never had a class like that before. It's not just busy work. We're actually learning stuff. How weird.
Go figure that. I don't know how much a university education costs today, but I hope you learned something. And speaking of learning, let's help people do that a little bit right now. So let's get in. So first up, are you worried that GMOs are, quote, unnatural? Well, as it turns out, maybe as many as 1 in 20 plants are naturally transgenic or GMO. Next up, 400,000 people. That's how many die from malaria every year. But as it turns out, gene editing and gene drives might significantly bring that number down in the coming years. And finally, maybe the strangest story we've ever covered, dating apps, gay sex, and drug use, syphilis running rampant after eradication appeared on the horizon. That's crazy stuff there. We'll get into that. But first up, Kevin, let's talk about so-called natural GMOs.
Yeah, this is really important because this is based on a study that came out in Plant Molecular Biology recently, in which the researchers who... they demonstrated that when you look at all of these different plant species that are out there, many of them associated with food or ornamental use, huge number of them actually contain evidence that there was a genetic transfer from Agrobacterium. So Agrobacterium is a plant pathogen that takes a little piece of its DNA and shoves it into the plant genome. And this is the mechanism that was exploited by genetic engineers like me to be able to deliver genes into plants that we want to see delivered. So in the bigger discussion of genetic engineering and whether or not it's safe or it works or whatever, there's evidence from the public databases that this has been happening for a long time without human intervention, and that actually has been, in some cases, a driver of domestication and a driver of certain plant traits that made them more able to compete in nature. So a process which is described as being horribly synthetic and artificial and laboratory is actually happening every day in Mother Nature's laboratory. So really cool stuff.
Just a fun fact before we move on, the monarch butterfly, which adorns every non-GMO project label, actually a GMO. Like several million years ago, it picked up viral DNA as part of its evolution. So that's fun to know. But the other thing I wanted to talk about is that the activist groups had trouble responding to this as studies like this came out. Like in 2015, another one came out about the sweet potato, about how it has, you know, some quote unquote foreign DNA in its genome. And the, you know, the typical groups we talk about, the only thing they could really say was, well, yeah, well, that's natural, but it's not natural for us to do it, you know? So they had to turn themselves in knots to try and explain why their initial complaints were valid. And in reality, they're not. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's just a good way to move a goalpost, right? I mean, it really is, because in the case of the sweet potato, it actually was a foreign gene insertion event that changed how the potato behaved in agricultural context. So it was serving humans better by having this freakish piece of foreign DNA that really does show that it and us are part of nature, and that to make better food, it's another way in which you can modify a genome to make a better product. And sweet potato fries all over the freezer case at my grocery store have non-GMO project labels on them, and I take a black marker and rub over them. It's like, you know, I'm a scientist. I have to stand up for something, you know. Why is that guy writing on the potato packages?
Oh, it's just crazy Kevin Folta. Have they ever responded to that, by the way, the non-GMO project? If I were them, I would just try to ignore that as much as possible.
Yeah, all of this stuff is inconvenient truth, and it's just examples that really kind of work against their mantra. And so there really is no good answer. What it's basically forcing them to do is split hairs, move goalposts, and many other analogies. The idea is just what we're doing in genetic improvement that's very directed is simply using a surgical version of what nature does on its own. And that is very, very hard for them to defend against.
You know, I don't know if it's exactly because of what we're discussing, but I think the movement is more or less running out of steam. And we've covered this a little bit in the past, but I see major groups like U.S. Right to Know, they're moving on to pesticides. They're trying to attack the technology still, but they're going a different route because the GMO labeling thing just imploded on itself. Or like a group like Union of Concerned Scientists, back in the day, they were big into the anti-GMO thing, like in 2009, I want to say. And now they're more concerned about climate change primarily and the impact of factory farming, you know, but they've gone away from attacking biotechnology. And same thing with Sierra Club, which we discussed earlier. So I think as this research comes out, maybe it's having some effect, but it just seems like the movement is just like having to reorient itself because it's not the same kind of a juggernaut it was a few years ago.
Yeah, well, the late Dr. Calestous Juma, he had a book called Enemies of Innovation, and it basically outlined all of these examples where things from, you know, ice to refrigerators to microwave ovens were all fought viciously as innovations because they seemed to threaten somebody in the status quo. And what you find is that ultimately these things do come to be very common and do become acceptable. And you're seeing the same thing here. A third of Americans are injected with a piece of biotechnology that protects them from a potential disease. You know, there's a lot of good applications happening now, and I think people are starting to see a little more hope than fear. And hopefully we've turned that corner.
Well, speaking of useful applications, let's talk about malaria and gene editing.
Oh, I love this. I mean, this is one of the stories that just gives me the chills because I think COVID has made this more tractable. We know that 500,000 people die every year from malaria. I mean, 500,000 die. There are as many cases as almost what, you know, population of the U.S. I don't know exact numbers, but between 200,000, 300,000 cases of malaria every year and huge number of deaths. So the total number of COVID deaths, which is huge, is about equal in the United States is about equal to how many people die of malaria every year. So what is malaria? Malaria is this disease caused by a plasmodium. And this is a single cell critter. It's spread by the African malaria mosquito, which is Anopheles gambiae. And the way it works is the mosquito picks this up from one person, this single cell plasmodium thing, bites somebody else, and a little bit of the saliva from the mosquito goes into the person. It lives in the salivary glands of the mosquito. So when they leave the mosquito and go into the arm of the recipient, they go to the liver and they hang out there in the liver and they multiply. And when they are ready, when they've made lots of new little plasmodia, the cells lyse, and all of this huge number of new single cell organisms go into the bloodstream and they kill blood cells. And they've got all these cool ways to evade the immune system. They actually cover themselves in the dead cell debris, kind of like Silence of the Lambs. They cover themselves in the dead cells so that they look like cells from the body. And so then the body doesn't respond to them. And it leads to all kinds of problems, from things as simple as fever and vomiting through, you know, diarrheal illnesses, brain damage, coma, and ultimately death. And this is vectored by mosquitoes. And there are trillions of them all over the planet. And each one makes lots and lots of eggs. And where you try to control this, you can't use insecticides aren't working anymore. Plus, you don't want to spray insecticides, especially in the developing world where they use old school stuff. And you'd like to limit that where you can. And then the anti-malarial drugs, there's evidence of resistance to those from the plasmodium. So there's a lot of problems. So you need some new technology. And that's really where this article steps off.
Okay, so before we get into the weeds, can you tell people what a gene drive is and how it works, and then maybe describe this specific application just to give us a better understanding of what's going on here?
Yeah, so this is complicated. So let's make it easy first. Gene drives, when you hear gene drive, think of this as a genetic strategy for population replacement. Okay, that's what it means. It's a genetic strategy towards population replacement. So it works something like this, that if you take a gene and put it into a plant or an animal or whatever, let's say a mosquito, and it's a gene that has some effect on the plasmodium. We'll get to this in a minute. Let's say that you put a gene in that mosquito, and then that mosquito goes out and mates. Half his offspring will carry it, half of them won't. But the half that won't will go mate with other mosquitoes, and now three quarters of them won't have it. And then the next round, even larger number, you know, 1/16 will carry it. What you see, and 15/16 won't. So what you see is that when you install a gene in an organism and let it out into nature, it's quickly diluted by the natural population. The gene drive installs a little piece of hardware that actually makes the gene you install present on all chromosomes where that in that organism. So in other words, that first generation will have it on both chromosomes. Then when that mates, it'll mate with somebody who has zero copies of it. The next generation, instead of getting one, will get two. And what you start to see happen is that now this starts to balloon. The prevalence of this transgene in the population increases. And this is what they mean by gene drive. It essentially drives the wild population to zero, replacing it, or near zero, replacing it with the modified population. Why is this good? All right, well, in the case of malaria, you can, and researchers have done this now, they've put genes into the midgut of the mosquito that secrete products or genes that attack the plasmodium. So essentially, you make mosquitoes that can't transmit malaria. They don't affect the mosquito. They don't affect its fitness, at least so far it looks like that. So you don't endanger the people who say that you're changing population structure and affecting mosquito preying, things like bats and birds. That's unaffected. All you affect is the mosquito's ability to carry the plasmodium and transmit it. And so that's why this is such magical technology.
Yeah, it really is incredible, the level of detail involved in this and the logic behind it too. It's so clever. And I've mentioned this before on the show. This is the sort of stuff that really got me interested in biotechnology because it just makes so much sense the way you would use it. You know, I went, oh, you know, this is really cool. You know, no wonder this is something all these researchers are pursuing. So how likely are we to see something like this in the near future? I mean, we know Oxitec right now is beginning to release their genetically engineered mosquito in Florida down where you are. So it's not unheard of to do something like this. So when might we see some application like this?
Yeah, here's the big difference. The Oxitec mosquito is a self-limiting mosquito. It has a gene that does not allow the larvae to survive. And so it basically drives the population very low and then goes away. So you're not changing the population structure. You're just decreasing the population that's there. In the case of a gene drive, you're taking the existing population and replacing it with something completely different. That's permanent, or at least until you can somehow get rid of all of it. And so that's where it's kind of has a little different ethical edge. You know, the Oxitec thing, I can make a lot of good arguments for. I don't have any problem with that. When you start looking at gene drives, you have to start looking at all of the other potential population dynamics, the sociological aspects of the people who would be affected by gene drives. You know, there's a lot of other debate that can be had around a gene drive than by, say, the Oxitec approach. The problem is, for me, is I'd love to have those debates, for one, because here's the issue. If you have a technology that can solve 500,000 deaths a year and hundreds of millions of cases, don't we have an ethical responsibility to use it? Imagine if we had the COVID vaccine and said, well, we haven't necessarily gone through all the ethical fine-tuning here, and we really need to consider all the sociological ramifications of the, you know, we don't do that. We said, let's solve the problem. But I have a feeling that there's a certain level of, you know, these are people over there, problems we don't have here, that if malaria was a problem here, people would want it. And also a lot of the do-gooders, the folks who say, well, we don't want genetic technologies used anywhere. And they tend to make a bigger stink when you're talking about potentially using this in the developing world. So I think that's where we're at.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And I don't mean to downplay the need to very carefully study this and consider the implications. If you know, I'm curious if you do know, how do you go about studying something like this? Because you said you're concerned about, you know, changing the structure of the population. So how do you look at something like this and try to weigh the risks and the benefits in a reasonable way?
Yeah, beats me. I think there's two levels. One level, which is the sociological level, that, you know, talking to people about it, making sure you have buy-in from a population of humans before you start doing something in nature. And as we've seen, that can be a tough nut to crack. But I think if our values really are about eliminating malaria, we can make that argument and find support for it. Then the question really is what are the possibility of problems that could happen in nature? You know, who could be affected or what species could be affected? You know, what can we best dream of for unintended consequences? And then test those things. I think we can have a very good handle on this. And, you know, to me, if this was a tool that I had and I would be making the decisions right now, it's a no-brainer. I would dive in and do this. And then when we solve a problem of malaria, you know, walk around with that as my evidence. Look, we saved 500,000 lives in the developing world. You know, that to me, that means much more.
Without a doubt. And I would agree. And I think I got to be careful what I say here, but if there is some kind of resulting problem, if it's not as great as other people dying from what may be a preventable disease, let's do it. You know, because sometimes, and Kevin, you can speak to this too, but sometimes these groups that oppose this technology, they will find potential problems, then they exaggerate it until it becomes absurd. But the average person doesn't know it's absurd. It just sounds like a really scary threat. And so we don't ever go, you know, that maybe there are some downsides to this, but overall it's very useful, you know? So I just hope we don't get stuck in that kind of bubble again.
Oh, you're totally right. They're doing it with Oxitec right now. If you look online, like Friends of the Earth, all they say is you're endangering native species and causing more virulent mosquitoes. They're saying, making all these claims that are totally bogus. And I actually invite them. I say, could you be on the podcast with me? And I'd really like to investigate those claims. And I put the Talking Biotech hashtag on there. If you're interested in looking at, you know, my interaction with them, the one-sided interaction, they, of course, they don't respond because they can't. They're there simply to manufacture risk, to diss a good technology and to introduce fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And I don't know why they want to do this. It's not being a friend of the earth. It's being a opponent of technology. And that's really what they are. You know, these aren't friends of the earth. These are opponents of technology. And they wrap themselves in that veil of being environmental stewards. The thing they forget is, well, you know, talking about this particular gene drive technology, if we had this and it worked with malaria, we could solve problems like Zika, chikungunya, dengue, you know, plague. There's all these other insect vectored diseases, and let alone crop pests, that we could suppress with these technologies. And many of these are invasives, you know, so they don't belong here anyway. So anyway, I'm rambling, but the basic idea is this is a really cool technology. I hope people talk about and get on the radar, because this will happen eventually.
If they were to interact with you, I think they'd end up on the business end of a steamroller. So I don't think that's ever going to happen, but I'd love to see it, you know. And they don't do debates at all, you know, in any of them, as far as I can tell. I think the only debate I've seen on this was in like 2014 when Charles Benbrook and Margaret Mellon, who at the time was with the Union of Concerned Scientists, I think. That's the only time I've seen like a live debate of people presenting evidence. And I think they just won't do that anymore, but maybe that's a good thing.
Now, I was on a debate with Michael Hansen once, and you know, and it wasn't a debate. It was him and his partner making up things and just going so fast, total gish gallop, like one thing to the next, where, you know, they didn't even read the studies they were citing. And especially his partner, who is a chef. who was quoting about, you know, BT being in the umbilical cords of babies. And I said, well, did you actually read that? You know, so how did you feel about the dose response that they were seeing and the level of detection through, you know, and she had no idea. Right. And but that's why, like, Friends of the Earth, but that's why I put it out there on Twitter to at least invite them and say, I don't know of these claims. I think it's fair and responsible of me to ask you to substantiate them, because if there is a real threat, we should talk about it. And that is an honest thing. If they have some data that say something to the contrary of what Oxitec says, let's talk about that. But they don't have that. And I think that comes up very clear to people who are on the fence.
Yep. Never, ever. They don't produce anything. They don't do research. They just put out scary stories. But speaking of things that are scary, syphilis.
Oh, I don't mean to laugh, but yeah, it is. It's scary. Yeah. So the story on this one is, once on the brink of eradication, syphilis is raging again. And this is April Domboski at NPR. And a really, really important story, because syphilis was almost gone. And syphilis was one of these old, you know, venereal disease, VD, STD things that, you know, back in the 70s when I was a kid, we would, you know, kind of joke about, you know, like, ah, yeah, you got VD, man, you know. And but it was basically eradicated by 2000. They're very, very rare. But then you started seeing rates going back up. And so why was that happening? And folks who are talking about it, like especially through Centers of Disease Control and other authorities, really said that back in the 1980s and 90s, the fear of HIV really led people to take on more safe sex strategies. So they were either using condoms when they were engaging, and they're being more careful about maybe who they engaged with or intravenous drug use, whatever. And that kind of went away. That really around 2010, 2012, you started to see more what they call pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. And pre-exposure prophylaxis was something that you could use to limit your likelihood of contracting AIDS from someone infected or HIV. And it was a pair of these nucleotide analogs that could disrupt the ability for the virus to do its thing. Long story short was that when you started to see that happening, plus HIV cocktails suppressing AIDS development, that people became a little more promiscuous, and that 50% of syphilis cases are showing up in gay men, and a substantial other amount in intravenous drug users. So syphilis is really being spread because of lax behavioral practices around sex and drug use.
So maybe the first moral of the story is don't do meth and then go to sex parties, which is an actual line from the story. I'm not pulling that out of thin air, but maybe one of the, and tell me what you think of this, Kevin, maybe one of the big takeaways from the story is that we need to constantly pursue new technologies and new medical applications of those technologies, because there's so many problems that we face. I just don't think we have, for one thing, the time, but the resources to solve all of them. And the story goes into some detail around how this really affects the homeless population. And you have women who are either very poor or homeless having children who are now being infected with syphilis. And of course, you already mentioned drug use, you know, so you have these problems that are all interconnected. And it just doesn't seem practical to try and solve them all individually. So maybe this is a great way to say, look, this is why we need to find permanent solutions to these, maybe through genetic technologies.
Well, that's a really good point. But, you know, the other big part of this is surveillance. And syphilis is not the easiest disease to diagnose. And especially when physicians haven't seen cases of it in a long time, and you find pockets of this happening. I guess it's really prevalent in San Francisco, certain areas, that physicians, you know, they have to recognize the symptoms, which is like fatigue and other kind of more vague symptoms, and then look for a specific rash. So they got to, like, you know, move your junk around and check the undercarriage and see if there's like a weird rash that is very characteristic of syphilis. It's a science podcast, right? So the basic idea is that there's some what can be rather cryptic hallmarks of the disease. So a lot of physicians were missing it. A lot of them are looking for it. The other big problem has been Obamacare. And the reason that it's a problem is because with the Affordable Care Act, a lot of the burden of primary care switched to the Affordable Care Act primary care physicians and away from STD clinics. And STD clinics are closing down because the people who used to visit them are now going to their other alternative physicians who may not be as good at diagnosing these problems. And I guess that's been a significant issue in places like San Francisco. The other big issue is that COVID has taken a lot of money and energy away from the remaining STD clinics. And so the disappearance of these places that were experts in detection has also kind of thrown gas on the fire.
Yeah, it's tough stuff. There's just no great answer. I mean, what do you, you know, based on reading this in the short run, is there anything we can do to try to ameliorate this?
Well, one of the things that was mentioned in the article is that dating apps were a big deal because it's anonymous. And so if two people hooked up and then one of them realized they had syphilis, they had no way to contact the other ones, because frequently these were, you know, one night hookups. One of the people in the article, Dan Wolfiler, who's an STD prevention specialist, said that it's faster than getting pizza delivered to your home. So, you know, either way you can hold the sausage, I guess. But the idea was the basic idea that you could get on these apps and find sex anywhere. You know, and so this is a part of it. The other big issue that we didn't talk about was that when you have babies that are infected, it also is kind of cryptic. It just shows up as a specific kind of rash that doctors have to recognize, because it can lead to blindness and deafness and all kinds of problems in kids. And so there's a lot of issues here. And the last thing maybe I'll touch on is that, you're also seeing, the article didn't touch on this, but there's a lot of syphilis going on in geriatric populations. Because I know, turn it off if you're eating dinner. the Greatest Generation is now hanging out in these concentrated living villages, you know, in these places around the country's retirement communities, which are, you know, 65 years of age and older. They're seeing these big spikes in syphilis. And a lot of that's due to you're taking a lot of people who are retired, who, you know, maybe are, you know, bored or whatever. You got Viagra, you know, you got all this going on. People who are looking for companionship. And then the thing about retirement communities is that women outpace men or outnumber men 10 to 1. And so I remember when the stories used to break about this, maybe about a decade ago, they said like you had people having sex on golf carts and stuff. It's gone wild out in the geriatric retirement villages. So, but large populations of syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, other stuff that's passing around there too. So, if you know, you have to be, I guess the basic rule is what were the avoid sex parties and drugs and retirement villages. If you're going cruising.
Oh, that's amazing, man. God said stop having sex and the nation's geriatrics said no.
We got little blue pills.
Anyways, who are you following on Twitter these days, Kevin?
Yeah, this is probably the best find I've had in a while is Dan Wilson, Dr. Dan Wilson, and he's at 20 Man Dan. And the reason I like Dan, his Twitter feed has some stuff here and there, and he follows some good folks and posts some good stuff, but it's a gateway to his YouTube channel. So he's got a YouTube channel called Debunk the Funk. And right now he's got anti-vax videos where videos against the anti-vaxxers. So anti-vaxxers, where he's dissecting the BS of folks like Mercola and Sayer G and all these folks one at a time. So if you can check out his Twitter feed and check out his YouTube stuff, it's fantastic. It's as good as it gets and is so necessary right now.
Excellent. I'm actually really interested to check those out. I love those sort of takedown videos. Well, on a related note, I'm going to recommend people follow Paul Offit, Dr. Paul Offit. He's a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's a big vaccine advocate. He's written, I want to say like 12 books now. And as a little bit of foreshadowing, he's going to be on the show with us next week to talk about how the anti-vaccine movement has operated during the COVID pandemic. So I'm really excited for that. And in preparation, follow him on Twitter. It's just at Dr. Dr. Paul Offit, O-F-F-I-T.
Awesome. He's a great follow and not just a really great scientist and a great communicator and a real advocate for public health. He's a really nice guy who will, he sat down with me on a number of occasions and I really appreciate him a lot.
Absolutely. And you guys will get to sort of chat with him next week or chat with him through us. But anyways, we're going to leave it there. So follow us on Twitter as well, at Cam J English, at Kevin Folta, geneticliteracyproject.org. And if you guys are liking the show, tell your friends, give us ratings on iTunes and Spotify. And if you're really liking what we're doing, consider giving us a donation. There's a little donate button at the bottom of each episode. It helps us improve the quality of the show, helps us get it out to more people. And we really, really appreciate that. And with that said, thank you guys so much. We will see you next week.